Welcome to the Taiz Fellowship Podcast. I'm Catherine Gretzinger. Today I'll be speaking to Chris Wood. His series on flooding on the Fraser River is on the Taiz right now at thetaiz.ca. Chris Wood has been interested in the climate and in water ever since he can remember. He grew up next to a river, spent his summers at a lake. He's lived on both Canadian coasts. He even lived on a boat for many years. In the mid-90s, when an ice storm wreaked havoc in eastern Canada and across the United States, Maclean's magazine asked him to write the introduction to their special issue. He spoke to scientists at the Canadian Climate Modeling Centre in Victoria, and they told him something that few people were talking about back then, that global warming wasn't just about heat, it was also about water. And that while year-to-year weather averages might only show slight increases, what those mask are new weather extremes within them. Deep droughts, torrential rains, heat spells, and ice storms. Chris started to think that those ice storms and the fact that spring comes 10 days earlier now than it did at the turn of the last century, those were both part of the same thing. He's been following this story now for the last decade. A year or so ago, he made a phone call to the folks who keep track of flooding in British Columbia. They told him about a new study, then as yet to be released, that the dikes around the Fraser River weren't up to scratch for the floods we can expect to see. They were built before global warming unleashed these new weather extremes. He wrote about that for the Taiz, and that story was picked up by the Vancouver Sun, the Vancouver Province, the Globe and Mail, and even CBC and CTV. Now, Chris Wood's latest series deals with what we're going to do about all of this. Right now, British Columbia is spending $30 million on new dikes, but they may not fit the bill. He and many others have suggestions now for what should be done about it. Chris Wood joins me to talk about it. Hello there.
Hi, Catherine.
Thank you very much for being with me today, Chris.
My pleasure.
Take me back to August 10th of last year when you put out the first series of reports on global warming. What was going on for you? What were you curious about?
Well, I was curious about how the changes, which are becoming ever more in focus from climate change, were going to strike us here in British Columbia. Now, if you remember back, we were just sweltering through one of the hottest heat waves practically in history at the time. And the Fraser River was not in flood, if it was anything but. In fact, shortly thereafter, it was going to record the lowest level that we've seen in recorded history on the Fraser. But what I was hearing was that climate change is going to bring us more rain in bigger downpours as we go forward. And in fact, looking back in the record, we've actually seen that. We've had more rain on average in British Columbia by about 3% a decade. It's been getting wetter on the wet coast. And more of that rain, we're being told, is going to appear not just in heavy rainstorms, but often in heavy rainstorms late in the winter, which will fall on top of snow. And, of course, you know, that sets the stage for the risk of very, very large volumes of water coming down the Fraser. And I thought, well, if we know this is happening, are we ready for it? And I started placing calls. And I found a couple of things that, frankly, left me concerned. One was that there had not been, at that point, for quite a number of years, any organized, concerted effort at the provincial level to maintain or upgrade the dikes.
And now, how can that be
neglected?
How can that be when you consider how many people live and work right alongside of one of the mightiest rivers in the country, the Fraser?
Well, half the lower mainland population lives behind dikes, so it's a very significant number of people. And I think it was simply an out of sight, out of mind. It hadn't happened lately. The last time we had a close call was in the late 90s, and it wasn't a burning issue on the plate of the politicians. And, you know, elected leaders, it's built into our system. They tend to focus on what's on their plate now, what is going to be certainly on their plate between now and the next election. And it's difficult to predict, certainly a year ahead of time, what the weather is going to be like the following spring. So as long as the water wasn't rising, it was easy to not worry about it too much. I think a couple of other things were at work. One of them was an institutional and perhaps a philosophical preference for pushing responsibility and the cost responsibility for as much as possible down from higher levels of government to lower levels of government. So we've seen the federal government offloading responsibilities and costs to the province. We've seen the provinces and British Columbia doing the same thing, offloading responsibilities and cost responsibilities down to municipalities. And they, too, have other priorities that on a hot, dry summer's day in August look more important than worrying about a flood that might not happen next spring.
Well, now, Chris, whose job is it to keep an eye on these diking systems and to make sure that they are appropriate for what's needed?
There are actually scores of different agencies that are responsible. In some cases, it's the municipalities. In some cases, it's First Nations. In some cases, it's regional diking authorities. And it's a very fragmented picture. So each of these individual agencies has some responsibility for some stretch of the river. But you wind up with a situation which is really only as strong as its weakest link. It doesn't matter if 90% of the dikes are up to strength, up to height. If that last 10% is crumbling or too low, the water gets through it, we've got a problem.
Now, when you put together all this information, not only the analysis that water levels are going to be rising and that global warming was a reality that's already bearing down on us, coupling that with the fact that you discovered that there was sort of no real gatekeeper looking after things, what started to go through your mind as a journalist?
Well, I was surprised that this was the case. I will have to be completely candid. As another journalist, you might appreciate this, that when I discovered there was a very salient piece of information that hadn't been reported, you get this kind of unsavory little thrill as a journalist saying, wow, you know, nobody else knows this. So you do get that kind of moment, I have to confess.
Your heart's pounding. You're ready to go to the next level.
That's right. You've got a scoop here. But that really isn't a particularly savory moment. I think the more important thing was that this was something which has the potential to be very, very dangerous. I had the opportunity to cover in the early 90s the biggest flood ever recorded on the Mississippi River. So I've seen firsthand what floods can do, and they are extraordinarily damaging of property. They cause more loss of life in North America than any other natural disaster. So this is a really huge potential threat. And my experience has been that people tend to disregard the river, particularly in the lower mainland. I mean, it's a problem. You have to get across it on the bridges. But very few people ever actually travel up and down the river and see it firsthand. And I've had the opportunity on boats to do that. And it's a much more kind of living thing, perhaps, to me in that sense than it is for some people. And it is going to rise. We're seeing that now. We're going to see it again. And it's too late if we wait until it rises to do something about it. So I suppose to draw that thought to its conclusion, my hope was that we would begin to see some attention paid to this. And I was gratified to see that the threat was in fact taken seriously by others in the media, at least, and the story was picked up, and we did see a good deal more attention paid to it in the last third of last year than had been before. And when the observations began to show we were getting a record snowpack, there was eventually money uncorked to begin to do something about it.
Now, I understand you sort of being tentative about the sort of salacious nature of this, that you do get jazzed up about knowing that you're going to run with the big story, but very soon after that feeling for journalists comes the sense of responsibility of how do I put this information out in a way that it's going to have impact. I mentioned in the introduction, you've mentioned again that those stories that you wrote in August did start a ripple effect, at least amongst other journalists. People started asking questions, but what has actually happened to address some of the concerns that you were able to raise?
Well, I think we have to look at that in two levels, if you like. I suspect that if the weather had given us a fairly low snowpack, if there hadn't been much snow over the winter, frankly, I suspect very little would have happened. But there was an additional awareness, certainly on the part of the people in municipalities who are responsible in a very direct way up and down the river, that there was an inadequate system in place to defend municipalities against a potential rise in the river. And then people began to see the snowfall and the rain come in the lower elevations, and it began to dawn on them that, holy cow, this might happen sooner than we think. And then back in, I think it was March, which is leaving it just a tad late, $33 million of provincial money was released to do some raising of the dikes, some erosion protection work, and all of that is certainly useful. I don't belittle it at all, and I certainly hope that it is sufficient to anything that we encounter in the next month. But it is not approaching a permanent solution or a permanent fix by any means. What that will do, if we're lucky, is dodge a bullet this spring. The erosion control is really designed to make sure that when water comes down at a high level, it comes down very fast. It doesn't erode the banks of the river. It doesn't erode dikes. It doesn't expose pipelines that run along the Fraser Valley. It doesn't disrupt transportation. Rail corridors and highway corridors, of course, come quite close to the river. So all of that is good, but it doesn't actually raise the dikes by 1 inch. Some effort has been put into raising the dikes, but most of that has been in, again, a temporary way. It's been sandbags. It's been cement lock blocks. It's stuff that, yeah, it's useful, but it's a temporary fix. It's kind of like, you know, you break a window in the house, you put plastic across it. That's nice. It keeps the wind out, but it's not repairing the window. And so far, to my knowledge, apart from a kind of general statement that, yeah, when this is passed, we'll have to do something permanent, nothing permanent really has been either put in place, nor has a process been undertaken to try and decide what that might be.
I want to talk a little bit more about what might be, but I think we should spend a moment just talking about the situation right now. The flood watch is on, and the rivers are rising. What kinds of reports are you hearing right now about the water situation?
Well, I spoke to the folks at the River Forecast Center, whose job it is to keep track of what is up in the interior. Most of our river freshet, as they call it, comes from melting snow. A certain amount may come from rain, but most of it comes from snow. And in fact, 80 to 85% of the snow that is waiting to melt is still up there. So even though the river has been rising, the vast majority of the water which could flow down is still waiting to come down. Now the question is, will it come down fast or will it come down slowly? And that's really a function of the weather. If we get a long, slow spring, you know, we should, in this particular occasion, really be hoping for cold weather, because cold weather will allow the snow to melt more slowly, and it will take longer to flow into the tributaries, into the Nechaco and the Thompson, and come on down. And that will be good for the flood situation. We should not be hoping for a really sudden onset of summer. If we get 2 or 3 weeks of blazing hot temperatures, then we're in trouble, because that will melt the snow very fast, and it will all come down the river at once.
Your story this week actually addresses this directly by saying you hate to be the guy who said, "I told you so," but you might just be in the position to be the guy saying that. What is that like for you to know that these warnings have been put out, the Band-Aids have been put on, but it just might not be enough?
Well, it's obviously a mixed feeling. I very, very much hope we do not have any problems. I have seen what those problems are like firsthand, and I would not wish them on anybody, let alone my friends and neighbors and relatives, you know, who live in the Lower Mainland. I hate even to say there's a silver lining to this, because if we get a really devastating situation, it's just that, it's devastating. I suppose what I might be hoping for is a very close call, you know, where the water comes out right to the edge and then begins to go back down again. That does send a proper scare through us, because as I look back over other jurisdictions, and I've been doing some research on this question, they have not gotten serious about undertaking the range of things that can be done to cope with flood risks until they've had, frankly, more than a scare, until they've had a major disaster. And that is probably human nature, you know, but it's part of our nature that we might do well to try to get past. I think we are going to have to do something. The only question is, will we be smart enough to do it in the wake of a close call, or are we going to wait until we have actually experienced the catastrophe and then decide that it's time to get serious?
You'd think that given the publicity around New Orleans and so many other areas in the world where flooding has been absolutely devastating, that it shouldn't take another wake-up call in our own backyard to prompt some action. What do you think is in the way of making this a top priority?
Oh, I expect it's the things that are always in the way. That happened somewhere else. Our systems can't possibly be as bad as their systems. They've got hurricanes. We don't have hurricanes. It's rationalizations. It's, to a degree, it's excuse-making. And it's also the fact that there are always other problems. You know, government is a complicated exercise. Simply running a society is a complicated exercise. And if the problem is not in my lap right now, it's just very easy to not worry about it right now. And we see this with so many other things. I could go through the sad, unhappy list of things that we don't address until we have a crisis. Again, I suspect that it's human nature, but it's not one of our more redeeming qualities as a species.
Okay, you pulled out your crystal ball. I'm going to pull out my limitless checkbook and tell you that I will offer this up to you and tell me what the solutions would be. What would you do if you had the wherewithal to do what needed to be done to create a system that would actually protect communities and people from flooding?
Well, some people who are probably smarter than I am have given this some thought with respect to the Fraser Valley. Other people who are directly responsible for the Fraser watershed have given it turns out, rather less thought than one might have expected. But what we need to do, I think, comes under a couple of headings. Yeah, those dikes are useful, but dikes have a number of downsides as a strategy for containing floods, and in fact, we detail those in the story that's on the Tai'i at the moment. So I won't recap that here. But there are alternative strategies, and I am going to be talking about that in a future report. But essentially, they make room for the river to be the river and to employ natural approaches to accommodating some of that water. And they're adopting some of those approaches right now in the Netherlands. They involve moving dikes back a little bit, giving a little bit more room for the river, allowing the natural floodplains to do what they naturally do. They involve identifying some areas where the river can be allowed to flood in a controlled fashion. And we don't have as much of that as we might like simply because of our geography, but we do have some areas. The eastern part of Lulu Island that Richmond sits on is relatively undeveloped. There's quite a bit of area just between sort of Hope and Abbotsford that is relatively undeveloped in the standpoint of industry or dense housing. So there are some things that we can do that would accommodate the flood rather than fight the flood. Those things certainly aren't cost-free, but frankly, nothing is going to come free in this. There are also perhaps some things that we could be doing upstream to slow down the water as it enters the tributaries, conceivably as it flows down through the tributaries. There are advantages to taking this kind of approach. You get much better habitat for wildlife. You get the possibility of water being encouraged to soak back into our aquifers, which is something which I talked about in this series last year. We're pumping water out of our groundwater in the lower mainland like crazy, and we don't really know how much is down there or give it much chance to go back in. There are some advantages to allowing rivers to spread out and soak down into the ground and recharge those aquifers. So there are some compensating sort of side advantages that would offset some of the cost. But to do any of those things, we really need to start first with taking an approach to looking at the problem, which is not as fragmented and not as focused on building dikes, which is very much a sort of one-dimensional solution. So I think as a starting point to open the door to some of those other strategies, what we need to do is take an approach that says, look, we've got a big river basin here, one of the biggest river basins in North America. We live down at the bottom. So whatever happens upstream from us is going to have an effect on us down here. Anything we might wish to do to put ourselves into a safer position down here is going to entail that whole river basin. That means we need to talk to everybody in the entire river basin. We have to accommodate their interests and concerns as well. But let's start that conversation. We have the Fraser Basin Council, which has a structure and, to a degree, some expertise to start that conversation. I was talking to the fellow there who deals with floods. In his recollection over the last 10 years, we've never had that conversation. So I think the very first thing we need to do is start that conversation and look at all of the options, not just the dikes, but all of the options, and then come up with a list of what is going to be practical, what is going to have the least impact on the environment, and what's going to have the best chance of letting the water, which is going to come down sooner or later, inevitably, pass through to the sea, sustain the environment along the way, and not wash us away.
Chris, do you get the sense that the people who have the power to make this conversation happen are going to?
I wish I could say that I do, but I have not got that sense. I have the sense that there are people who are, I guess, at the middle levels of things. The folks who are responsible for stuff on the ground would like to see that conversation started, but they are captive, if you like, to the decisions of the folks who are farther up the food chain and the political system. And to be honest, no, I don't have that sense. When I tried to get some response from the province to the series that we ran last year, didn't hear back, have tried to get some response to this year's follow-up, and again have not heard back. They may be thinking along these lines. I hope they are. I cannot say that's the case.
Well, you certainly are. I know that there's a book in the works, Rough Weather Ahead. How long before we're going to be able to walk into a bookstore and pick it up?
Well, Rough Weather Ahead was your title for the series, actually, for the Tai'i. The book's title is Dry Spring. That's the working title. And I hope it'll be out in time to be read by what I hope will not be quite such a raging river next spring.
Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. And I look forward to reading more. And I very much hope that your best case scenario comes to pass.
I'd hate to say I told you so.
Thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thanks, Catherine.
Bye for now.
Chris
Wood, the journalist, talking to me today about how we know about floods, what we know, and just what is being done to deal with them. You can read much more about Chris's research and his work on the Tai'i.ca. His series from last summer is still available to you online. That is August 10th is the dateline on that. And this week, writing again about the threat that the river rising poses to people in and around British Columbia. I'm Catherine Gretzinger. This has been a Tai'i Fellowship podcast. For more stories and podcasts, you can visit us at thetai'i.ca. Thank you very much for listening.